All rise. The Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. We are here for oral argument in our case number CV-240920, Salazar v. Wilson. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and also being live streamed. So, counsel, we ask you to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. No need to feel obligated to take the entire time, but it is certainly there if you feel you'd like to use it. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion for rebuttal if you'd like. Also, please keep in mind that we have read the briefs and have conferenced the case this morning. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Horn, appearing on behalf of Arceli Maldonado, who is the daughter of the now deceased Hilda Salazar, and the statutory wrongful death plaintiff in this case. And I apologize in advance if I get a little emotional. I was a friend of Hilda, who started complaining to her family doctor in 2018 of abdominal lump and corresponding symptoms such as severe pain and bleeding. And in December of 2018, when her cancer was in its infancy, she saw the defendant and appellee, Dr. Wilson, for a surgical consult. And she was told, there's nothing to worry about. Just keep taking her birth control medication, which she had been taking for these symptoms already. In October of 2019, so nearly a year later, when the pain was too much to handle, she was finally scheduled for surgery by Dr. Wilson, only to then be told that wasn't going to happen because her insurance wasn't going to cover it. So they rescheduled it out into 2020 so she could work out her insurance. And the only time that Ms. Salazar heard anything about cancer since the first time she met Dr. Wilson was in January of 2020 when the emergency department performed surgery. And she discovered that it was stage 4 and that she should start planning her funeral. Now, as the court is aware, this is a medical malpractice wrongful death case about the duty of doctors such as Dr. Wilson to give people the chance they deserve to survive, whatever that chance may be. Now, of course, we're here today to talk about the restatement in the Thompson case. But before I get there, I just wanted to highlight the DeMontini factors that we've cited about when a plaintiff is entitled to a jury instruction. The trial court must give a requested instruction if the evidence presented supports the instruction, the instruction is proper under the law, and 3, the instructions pertain to an important issue and the gist of the instruction is not given in any other instructions. And I think that's
I have a question about the record.
Of course.
Did you lodge the trial transcripts with us?
We did, Your Honor.
Okay, because I didn't see them in the record. You filed a notice of lodging, and then which listed the trial transcripts for every day of the jury trial, but then your actual notice of filing certified transcripts just lists the hearing or hearings on August 2nd, August 29th, and August 30th, and no trial transcripts.
If that's the case, Your Honor, I'm certain that we did, and I actually brought the relevant transcripts that we cited with us. I could hand them to you, Your Honor, if you want. But if they're not part of the record, this is the first time we've been notified of that, and we'd like the opportunity. I don't know if there's an objection to that, but
I thought maybe you had them in your appendix, but. it didn't look like they made it into your appendix.
We've cited the, it's part of the index of record, Your Honor.
Right.
Your Honor, for the record, I brought the excerpts we've cited. It's at index of record 190. This is from Wednesday, September 4th, 2024, trial AM session, 191, and this is cited in our reply. IR 191, this is trial day 2 p.m. session, and that was 191, and then 192 is Thursday, September 5th, 2024, that we've cited.
But I think in civil cases, we don't automatically have access to the transcripts. You have to separately provide them to us. And I think it might be too late at this point for you to do so.
Okay. Well, it's because they're actually listed in the index of record.
Right.
So my understanding is that you get the record from the trial court. So we'd appreciate the opportunity to supplement those. We cited them, and I believe opposing counsel has them as well, so I don't think there's any prejudice.
Yeah, I think he does too. I mean, he cites them in the answering brief. So, I mean, I think you can file a motion asking to supplement the record with them.
But yeah.
For purposes of today, we can move on. I just wanted to see if I was right that they weren't.
Well, I'm not,
we didn't separately get copies from you.
Okay. We apologize for that. I'm not, not the person that my end on the office that handles filing, so I can't say one way or the other. But I know that we paid for them and that we filed them at some point, and I know that they're part of the index of record. I don't think that there's any dispute between counsel that the record is what we've cited.
Right. I think the dispute is whether the evidence in the record even supported the instruction to begin with, and it's hard for us to decide that issue without having copies of the transcripts.
Well, Your Honor, the trial court did not refuse to give the instruction because the evidence didn't support it. That was not the court's reasoning.
It was Thompson, right?
Yes, correct, Your Honor. And we've got a big enough hurdle with Thompson to overcome, so we would greatly appreciate if we can do whatever we need to do to get the transcripts to the court. I think it's a very important case, an important issue, and I think the court's mercy is appropriate here if we do not technically file them correctly.
Counsel, let me ask you a question on Thompson and express my condolences for your client's
loss.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
Factor number two, the instruction is appropriate under the law. If Thompson is not dicta, then our hands are tied on this. Would you agree?
Yeah, and if that's the court's decision, I understand that. I've got two things to say. One is I think that we have an argument that you're not bound by, even if it's not dicta, which I'll get to shortly. But the second point I want to make is if that is the court's decision, Thompson needs to be changed because it's wrong. It's dead wrong if that's the case.
But if it's wrong, if it's wrong, that's not our call, correct? It would need to be the Supreme Court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we would like an opinion that helps us to get them to grant cert and change it, if that's the case.
So what would that opinion look like then? You want us to criticize Thompson?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think, and getting back to Dave Montini, this third factor, the instruction pertains to an important issue. And I think DeMontini cited a case that cites it, but I like the language of DeMontini when it says the gist of the instruction is not given in any other instructions. And I think that gets us to the almost philosophical question of what is this restatement? It's clearly not a cause of action. You know, they've said we've got to put this in our pleadings. This is not a separate cause of action. So what is it? And I think there's a, I'd like to read a quote from Thompson that I don't know that we've been paying enough attention to. And it says, "But where the law governing duty encompassed the chance interest within its range of protection and the harm from which defendant was to have protected the plaintiff occurred, greater latitude is given to the trier of fact to find causation under any plausible theory. Hence, the interest which the law is protecting is the chance itself. And the chief problem is the evaluation of the chance, which is a function peculiarly within the province of the jury." And that's the quote, but I think the most important part of that quote is, greater latitude is given to the trier of fact to find causation. So the question is, why are we refusing to tell that to the jury?
Yeah, it does seem odd to me that the jury is allowed to consider it, but we don't tell them it's allowed to consider it.
That's the crux of the problem. And we have no problem telling the jury that when we have a heightened burden of proof. It's almost as if, in reading the Thompson decision, there is a distrust of the jury to not follow what they're told. And, you know, from having done trials before, you know, I know that juries take their instructions very seriously, and they're going to follow their directions. And there's this notion that a directed verdict is a way of escaping the distrust of what a jury is going to do.
Right, but so that, Thompson's a rule that I think allows more cases to get to the jury.
Right.
But then Thompson's trying to thread this needle and say, but we maybe then don't trust the jury with the ultimate decision based on mere probabilities.
Precisely. Right. So it's, we're going to let it get to somebody we don't trust because of this underlying important issue of protecting chance of survival. We should be telling the jury, my opinion, Your Honor, that they have that latitude. This case is different, right? Doctors have this special duty to protect their chance. And if they screw that up, they can be held accountable. And this is what it says. It says, if you find that this chance was taken from them as a result of negligence, and you find that it's a substantial factor in the death, then you can find, you don't have to, but you can find for the plaintiff.
Right. And did you have expert testimony saying that your client's chances of survival would have been greater had the defendant acted in a way that was consistent with the standard of care?
We do, Your Honor. And we have accurate, at least I think the reply, we have a section on that with very important citations, including that she would have had an 80% chance had this been taken care of shortly after seeing Dr. Wilson in August of 2018.
And Thompson says your expert doesn't even have to quantify.
Correct, Your Honor. And I actually brings me to an important part, and after this I'd like to reserve rebuttal, but what if the expert testimony said she had a 40% chance and then she had none? Then you send them to a jury and you tell them, we've got to show a 51% chance. Well, what's the point? Just grant a directed verdict, right? If I may save the rest for rebuttal, Your Honor. Yes, of course. Yes, yes.
Can you explain to us how, in your view, this discussion in Thompson is about whether it needs to be an instruction or not? Thompson says you don't instruct the jury, how that's dictated.
Right. Yeah, well, I think one important thing is the jury instructions were different in Thompson. And one important difference is here the jury instructions say you have to find that the death would not have occurred absent the negligence. And that's an incorrect statement of the law that can be cured with the restatement instruction. We look at them as a whole, right? So I'm fine with the instruction, as long as we get the instruction that says you can make that leap on your own. You don't have to have additional evidence that gets you to 51%. So I think in this case, the instructions are different, and as a whole, this was required in this situation. And Thompson doesn't say it's never appropriate. It just said in this case, the judge didn't have to. But I do disagree with that, but I think at the same time, there's wiggle room to say, in this case, it was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm David Toon, and I represent Dr. Wilson and the practice group Southwest Contemporary Women's Care. There is, as the discussion just now shows, there's an issue that can be discussed even without the trial transcript, and that's the nature of the instruction that's at issue. And I want to point out first that on the plaintiff's side, they offered or stipulated to the standard Raji instructions on burden of proof, proving a probability of causation, that causation is the plaintiff's burden to prove. And if the judge had given the instruction, the supplemental instruction that was requested, that would have conflicted with the standard instructions that plaintiff on the plaintiff's side they themselves agreed to.
Yes, what is your understanding about whether we have the transcripts or not?
I
don't know.
I have to confess that I can't confirm or deny that they were filed. I know that they were designated, and
right.
We offered some supplemental designation, and then it was, of course, the plaintiff's burden to file the transcripts. And I took it for granted that that had been done.
And you didn't argue that we should apply our Cap 11 and treat the transcripts as not filed and assume that everything in the record supports your position. You didn't argue that, right?
I did not argue that.
Okay. Do you agree to his requested relief of supplementing with the transcripts, if that's a motion?
I'm sorry?
Do you agree to counsel's oral request to supplement the transcripts?
I would agree to an oral request to supplement the record with the trial transcripts.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
As the court knows, we've argued what's in those transcripts extensively in our answering brief, and I would like to have that before the court.
Okay.
But there is this one issue that can be resolved, and I want to point out the most fundamental, the most important point to remember in this appeal is that the trial judge did exactly what the Thompson ruling said he should do, and that is to permit evidence of probability of possibilities and permit counsel to argue that. And the judge expressly stated, you can argue the evidence. But then they did not argue that there was any increased risk of harm. They did not say there was evidence of a possibility and you should consider that as an increased risk of harm. They didn't do that.
Thompson said, you know, has its discussion, and then there's an interesting line in there. It says, the jury is still instructed that they must find for the defendant unless they find a probability that defendant's negligence was a cause of plaintiff's injury. Did the jury here get that instruction or something similar?
Well, it's broken down in the Rajis. In the burden of proof instruction, it says, the burden of proof in this case is probable. And then you combine that with the definition of causation and the statement that it's the plaintiff's burden to prove causation. And from those two instructions, that permitted us to argue, ladies and gentlemen, they had the burden of proving that the alleged conduct, the alleged negligence, probably caused the injury. So, I think you have to take it from those two separate instructions and put it all together. But as the court points out, I mean, the trial judge's instruction specifically was, we are not changing the law and what the burden of proof is. It's still probability. We're just going to give the jury some leeway to consider evidence that might fall short of that and leave it to their discretion. And I've argued extensively that, you know, there are some problems with, I see some problems with that. But for purposes of this appeal at this level, the proceedings, the trial judge did the only thing that he could do. He followed Thompson versus Sun City to a T. It was clearly Thompson case that the plaintiffs invoked and the loss of chance doctrine that's stated in that opinion. And if there's any room for the plaintiff to request an instruction, it's subject to that limitation of the court. They said, because we're not changing the burden of proof, it still has to be probable causation. Because we're not changing that, we're not going to instruct the jury differently. All we're talking about here is, as Your Honor stated, more cases are going to get to the jury. Kind of takes away the directed verdict, the motion for judgment as a matter of law. I want to follow up on a little bit of the discussion we just heard. There was no expert testimony that the chances would have been greater with earlier diagnosis and treatment.
Not from Dr. Autry or Dr. Levine?
Correct. Dr. Levine was the oncologist to testify, and he said there would have been an 80% chance of five-year survival with an earlier diagnosis, but he never defined the other end of that. What were the odds with a later diagnosis? He never said that. So I think we're already allowing the jury some latitude to speculate. I think we've got to at least exactly define what the change in the chance was. What was the increase of risk? How are we going to let a jury make this subjective determination? Is this evidence sufficient to establish causation if we don't give them some definite parameters? What was the risk with an earlier diagnosis versus the risk with a later diagnosis? And that was not there. And I want to add that this when we're talking about what the risk was and what the difference was with an earlier diagnosis or a later diagnosis, it has to be linked to a standard of care failure. It has to be linked to negligence. And all the experts to testify at trial agreed that the only way to diagnose a leiomyosarcoma is to do surgery. So was there a standard, did the standard of care require Dr. Wilson to do surgery at the earlier time that the OBGYN expert was Dr. Autry? I've read his testimony, and I know the court hasn't had an opportunity to do that yet, but I do not find where he said that the standard of care required surgery at the time when the earlier diagnosis might have been made. That was 2018. Versus 2019, he never said that the standard of care required Dr. Wilson to somehow compel his patient to undergo surgery.
So the proximate cause instruction ends with, and without which the injury would not have occurred. How is that consistent with a loss of chance or an increase in probability of the injury occurring?
Well, I think that the proposed supplemental instruction would be inconsistent with the instructions that the court gave. Instructions, as I've said, plaintiff side stipulated to those. And I think we just heard counsel say again, I'm fine with the instruction. He just thinks that there should have been a supplemental instruction given. And I respectfully disagree. There's a big change there.
I think he also argued that that particular instruction is inconsistent, at least in a loss of chance case.
The supplemental.
He had two arguments. One was Thompson, one it's dicta, or we should somehow distinguish Thompson. And two, the causation instruction that was given is inconsistent with the ability to argue loss of chance to the jury. Because it says without which the injury would not have occurred. And that, I think, to a normal person would mean something other than just a mere loss of chance?
Well, I'm not sure I follow that, Your Honor. The inconsistency is in the different descriptions brought by the instructions regarding causation. The Raji instruction says probably caused the death, and that's how we instructed the jury. And then they wanted to change that to substantial factor in bringing about the death. And so those aren't the same thing. And substantial factor is actually a term that the Arizona Supreme Court itself in McDowell versus Davis has criticized and said, this is so vague, we should not be using it as a jury instruction. And the commentators to the restatement, the third restatement of torts, have all said, pointed out, they've gone for pages about substantial factor and how that's confusing and it's outlived its usefulness and it can mean different things to different people. And I think it would have been very problematic to instruct the jury in this case on substantial factor. So we're looking at more than just, do we like Thompson or not? We're looking at the particular instruction that was offered in this case. And to say substantial factor in bringing about the death, who knows what that means? Because causation in the instructions is actually defined.
But again, though, the instruction in Thompson was that they must find for the defendant unless they find a probability that defendant's negligence was a cause of plaintiff's injury. And if you line that up against without which the injury would not have occurred, you think those two things are consistent?
Well, what I hear from the Thompson instruction is really what the court gave in this case.
Because of the burden of proof instruction about more probably true than not?
And the way we define causation in the standard instructions, we define that. Well, it's what the court said, but negligence causes an injury if it helps produce the injury, and if the injury would not have happened without the negligence. And that's the exact language from Medical Negligence 1, Raji Medical Negligence 1, which the court gave. If it helps produce the injury, and if the injury would not have happened without the negligence. I think that certainly, that gives leeway to argue an increased risk of harm if the evidence were there to support it, but they didn't argue that. Your Honor,
it's possible the Rajis just haven't picked up on that sentence in Thompson where it explains the instruction that was given in that case that sort of captures loss of chance and gives the jury the opportunity to figure that out.
Well,
Rajis aren't always right.
They're an excellent starting place, and they do get evaluated and modified regularly.
Sure.
I think we're up to Raji 7 now. So I think we do have a lot of people taking a look at that. But the Thompson instruction, Your Honor, I just read the Thompson instruction?
Yeah. So it's on, and if, I don't know if you need... I have the Westlaw printout, and it's right at 608. The jury is still instructed that they must find for the defendant unless they find a probability, and a probability is italicized, that defendant's negligence was a cause of plaintiff's injury.
Yes. And they go on to say there was no need for the judge to do more than instruct on the general rule, general principles of probability and causation. Specifically, the judge had no obligation to draw the jury's attention to the legal rule, which allowed evidence to be introduced and argued. And I think that happens all the time in lawsuits. We have legal rulings.
Sorry to interrupt. So you would say then that the burden of proof that talks about probabilities combined with the definition of causation is consistent then with that additional part that you read?
I think it's consistent, and it's especially consistent with Thompson stating we're not changing the burden of proof on causation. It still has to be proven to a probability. If we're going to change that, that's a pretty big discussion, which has not taken place. So, uh, I just want to reiterate that there was no expert testimony on the reduction in the odds of recovery. Most importantly, there was no standard of care testimony that said Dr. Wilson was required to perform surgery at the time of his first consultation in late 2018, and when the patient was first referred to him, and that was the time in question.
And I'm sorry, I think you may have said this, but I just want to be super clear. You're saying in closing argument, plaintiff's counsel did not argue loss of chance?
They did not argue loss of chance. And this is, as I pointed out, in the answering brief, they didn't cite the record at all in the opening brief. They didn't say what evidence supported the requested instruction. And then they came back in the reply brief and said some things, which I haven't had a chance to respond to. I don't think references to that evidence should be considered at all. But it does say there that their expert testified there was an 80% chance of recovery with an early five-year survival with an earlier diagnosis. So, and that's what they argued. They did argue at trial in closing argument. It's more likely than not that with an earlier diagnosis she would have survived. So if there was evidence of a probability, why are we even talking about Thompson? Why are we talking about having to rely on increased risk? And they did not come back in this second bite of the apple and say, oh, by the way, the evidence did show a change in the degree of risk. They just said earlier diagnosis, 80%. And their argument is that Dr. Wilson's failure took place at that time. So if there was an 80% risk, then there's no reason to even talk about Thompson at this point. And I've talked about there being substantial evidence to support the jury's general verdict, and I've searched for case law and general verdicts, and I don't see anything contrary to the argument I've offered. And the counsel did spend time on that in the reply brief. But what I think it boils down to is this: was there a discrete element of the cause of action that, if decided in Dr. Wilson's favor, would support the jury's verdict? And was there substantial evidence in support of his position on that? And there was. There was substantial evidence that he met the standard of care, that he was not negligent. We start at the appellate level with an initial presumption that the judgment of the trial court was correct. A general verdict implies a finding by the jury on every essential fact in favor of the prevailing party. And we do have this discrete issue, standard of care. Did he meet the standard of care? Was he even negligent at all? Do we even need to move on to the causation argument? And the answer is no. There was substantial evidence the jury could rely on to decide the case in Dr. Wilson's favor on the standard of care issue.
I guess I'm not sure the evidence matters if the jury wasn't properly instructed.
Well, we're talking about how to instruct the jury on causation.
Right.
And that they are two very discrete things that we treat very differently. The lawyers, we have different experts to address those issues. Standard of care versus causation is very often, usually different. Sometimes it's the same, but it's very often different experts, and we treat them very differently. So I see standard of care as a discrete issue that, if it supports a general verdict, if there was substantial evidence in Dr. Wilson's favor on that. So I'm getting close to the end of the time, but I think that covers the essence of what I need to do, and so I'll take the advice that I don't need to use the entire 20
what,
minutes.
Wasn't advice, just pointing out.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honors, I'd like to start with the McFarland case he's referring to about whether the evidence supported the verdict. McFarland does not apply harmless error doctrine applies. And in fact, the McFarland case itself talks about substantial evidence, and then they talk about a jury instruction issue, and they immediately go to harmless error and in a few sentences, and they said it, in this case it was harmless error, but the McFarland doesn't apply here, and Your Honor is correct. If the jury is not instructed correctly, this is not the analysis we use.
What about opposing counsel's point that the burden of proof instruction talks about the probabilities is more probably true than not true, and that that captures that combined with the traditional causation instruction captures the essence of what Thompson talks about in the paragraph that I kept reading?
Well, I don't think that it is sufficient, Your Honor. I think that the instructions as the Raji has them, last sentence is literally the death wouldn't have happened but for, and I think that is the soul of the issue we're talking about is.
Is there not but for causation in a medical negligence action? Maybe the answer is no, because it's a loss of chance, and so.
I would say, in terms of the evidence presented, the answer is no, it was stated that the burden of proof hasn't changed. I disagree with that. This is the black letter law that was adopted in Thompson, which is kind of ironic that I'm now fighting in, right? But the burden of proof has changed. The jury is given more leeway, and so we should tell them that, and that is the gist that wasn't caught in any of the other instructions, so to speak. If we hadn't presented sufficient evidence of falling below the standard of care and causation, we would have never made it to a jury. So the first section in our reply is a loss of chance jury instruction was supported by the evidence, and we have specific citations in there, and one of them was somebody of age and health, 80% survival rate had her cancer been treated early. And he further testified that because of the low-grade sarcoma, quote, wasn't treated, it was allowed to become more aggressive with more mutations in a process that continued from 2018 to 2020. The classic case of loss of chance. We will immediately file those transcripts and this section of the reply. And I believe the Hilda's deposition, which we took while she was still with us, is in the appendix.
It is.
And that was a lot of that was read into trial, and that's in the transcripts we'll be filing. And what she testified to was she wanted to get surgery, and he told her that it's not necessary. This was the first visit. She became 6 months pregnant looking. That's how big it got. And they finally scheduled surgery because she demanded it, and then they extended it out because of her insurance. So the evidence is definitely there to support our case, and we'd ask that the court take a careful look at that. And jury instructions are not supposed to have to be argued by the lawyers. The jurors are supposed to be instructed on the law, and that puts, a plaintiff's attorney who's, suing a doctor in a precarious position to then say, well, you know, she lost a chance, even though that's not what the court told them. So it may have been strategy, I don't know, but that's not our obligation to instruct the jury on what the law is. It's our obligation to ask the court to do that, and that's what we did. A substantial factor is a prototype of something a juror can understand, as opposed to proximate cause. There's nothing ambiguous about substantial factor. That's something everybody can understand, and it's not only in the statement, it's in the Jones case. We've cited it in our brief. Jones reversed because of the failure to give this instruction. And I haven't seen another state that's adopted their statement and found that the jury shouldn't be instructed on it.
Counsel, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Time's up.
Thank you.
It's really unorthodox for the court to rule on an oral motion and oral argument. I've never seen it done, but given that opposing counsel doesn't object to you supplementing the record with the transcripts, we'll go ahead and allow you five business days to file those.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your written briefs and for your argument. You've given us much to consider. We'll take it under advisement. We'll be in recess for a few minutes to allow the next oral argument to set up. Thank you.